On an old familiar shoreline, I found a feather in the sand. And as the water tries to reach me, I try to understand. Am I really where I come from? Am I never?
Welcome back to The Download. Justin Kaufman, Dave Hoekstra sitting in for Justin tonight. And our next segment, we went up to Chelsea, Michigan a couple weeks ago to talk to actor, singer, songwriter, RV enthusiast Jeff Daniels. He's going to be at City Winery on October 26th. That was a bit of a song called A Michigan and Me. There's also video from John Saul on the Nocturnal Journal Facebook page. But this is a nice little interview from Jeff Daniels in Chelsea, Michigan. So tell us, what was your inroads into music? I mean, what got you into music? Was it music around the family, music around the house, just your early memories of music?
Growing up, my dad played piano. He was a big Nat King Cole fan. And he had seen Nat King Cole at the Drake Hotel in Chicago and sat at the table 10 feet from Nat King Cole. And I'll never forget it. And he would play this jazzy stuff on this little upright, not even half upright spinet that we've got here in the studio now. And he said, why don't you play piano? And I tried, and I never really got into it. I fell in love with Elton John and Bernie Taupin, and then I was just starting to, you know, bang chords like Elton can do sometimes, and that wasn't what the piano teacher wanted. So I kind of let it go. And when I moved to New York in 1976, I went to Herb David Guitar Store in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and bought a Guild D40. And just, I knew three chords and threw it in the back of the car and moved to New York City. And I knew that I wanted music in my life somehow, and that was very mobile. The acoustic guitar, you could take anywhere, and that was why. You can't drag a piano around with you. We didn't have keyboards back in 1976 like they do now. So that's what I did, and I'm glad I did, because I, you know, courted my way through James Taylor and John Denver and Dan Fogelberg, and then a friend of mine said, you should learn how to finger pick. And then I got the tablature books from Stephen Grossman and Doc Watson. Now all of a sudden you're playing Deep River Blues and you're going, okay, what is this? And then you discover the Delta Blues guys. And then you learn the blues scales or pentatonic scale, whatever that is. And all of a sudden now the guitar is fun. And then I was hooked. At the same time, in when I first went to New York in the late 70s, I was around playwrights, off-Broadway, Circle Repertory Company, Lanford Wilson, who went on to win a Pulitzer Prize for Tally's Folly, a play that they did in New York and on Broadway, won the Pulitzer for it. That's who's walking around this morning in the offices of Circle Rep. And in 1978, we were doing a play at Circle Rep, and I had my guitar up there with a John Hogan friend of mine who played. And Lanford was listening, and I wasn't very, I was writing songs, you know, that just were, you know, you're 23, 24, there ain't a lot of depth there. And he goes, let me help you. And he wrote a song called Road Signs about a bus trip that he took from Missouri, where he lived as a young man, to Chicago to work in an ad agency. And then after a year or so in Chicago, he went to New York City and became a playwright. But on that bus trip to Chicago, he wrote Road Signs, which was basically a poem, but it's about the people on that bus. It's about America. It's about diversity. It's only Lanford could write that way. And he handed it to me, and he said, see if you can do something with this. And I went down to they had a piano and in the theater against a wall, and, you know, piano, basically all I'm good at is A minor, G and F. And so I found something in A minor and I put some chords to it, and the song has stayed with me. We're doing it in the show. To do the acoustic version of it with Ben's band is just beautiful. written by a guy who won a Pulitzer, who handed it to me in 1978.
Wow.
I like that.
Wow.
But I did, it was about the writing and following guys like Stevie Goodman and John Prine. And go, what are they doing? What they're not doing is what Elton John and the Beatles and the Dave Clark Five and all those bands, Led Zeppelin and the Who. I'm not going to be that. What's Prine doing, though? Because, you know, Hello in there, Sam Stone, and then Goodman proved you can write well, but you can also write funny. And then I saw Christine Lavin, who basically performed going, it's okay to do comedy, it's okay. And then it became, well, then now I can, well, that opens up a whole other thing, which then the writing, then I ended up later writing songs about, you know, the Dirty Harry Blues, what it's like to get shot and killed by Clint Eastwood in a movie. You know, Christine Lavin and Stevie Goodman gave me permission to write that way and not worry about, is anyone going to buy it? Is a record label going to? No, they're not. Nobody gives a crap about me and my music in the music industry. I just get to play. And if people want to come out, great. And it's worked out. You know, I've been doing it about 15 years, and those who give me a shot come back. That's what happens when you woodshed for about 40 years before you go out.
When I reviewed your stuff, I did. I mentioned Goodman and Loudon Wainwright. And stuff.
Arlo,
yeah. I mean, it's humor, but it's also an eye for detail. You
know detail. I mean? That's the playwright. Yeah. Wilson, the imagery. Yeah.
What are the different disciplines in writing a play and writing a song? I mean, obviously one's shorter, but how do you approach each one?
The detail, what's similar is the rhythm. The rhythm of, you know, a lyric has a rhythm, otherwise it doesn't fit the line. Shakespeare is all about iambic pentameter. You do Newsroom, written by Aaron Sorkin, there is a rhythm to that. It may be a long speech, but there's a rhythm in there. And once you find that, it rolls, just like one lyric into another. And that's the similarity. It's similar to writing, you know, when you write a first draft of a song, or you throw anything into it, just like you would write the first draft of a play. You don't you learn through experience not to judge it early, and to write badly early. Those are similarities, and then it all comes down in the rewriting. All the great writers, you know, will tell you that writing starts when you start to rewrite.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can't rewrite a blank page. People come to the theater and they, not so much now at the Purple Rose Theater Company in Michigan, they'll come and they'll go, I got this idea for a play. I got about 15 pages. You want to read it? I don't know. You want to just let me know? I said, talk to me when you have 100 pages, when you have a beginning, middle, and an end. Because until you do, I'm not interested. Get to work. And that's that. The writing process is maddening, and yet it's fascinating, because when it works, and when you find that one and it falls, and you, whether through a lot of work or it just falls out, that's a thrill. Writers say you never finish, you just abandon what you're doing. And certainly with songs, sometimes you actually finish them. Grandfather's Hat song I wrote years ago, I still wouldn't change a word in that. Not all of them. Some of them are, you go back to them and you go, oh, I got to change that. That's just, what was I thinking? But with a song, at least you have the opportunity, if you've done it right, where you can actually finish it.
Michigan and Me, I remember that. I like that one.
Michigan and Me is, that's an anthem to, you know, those who, where Michigan is home. It goes with any state, you know, the lure of home. You know, the opposite of Tom Wolfe, you know, of you can't go home again. Well, you can, it's just different.
Again, I guess it's true with wherever you lived. All your travels make you appreciate home more.
Yeah, especially when you get older and our family is growing. And we've stayed close as a family on both sides. That's essential. I mean, if it's dysfunctional, then I wouldn't blame anybody for hitting the road and never coming back. But I don't regret the decision to not live in Hollywood or New York. nothing against those the people in the industry or the industry, but I need a disconnect. I need a break from not only other actors or movies or the theater or all that. I don't live, there are other things I want to do, and there are other things I want to be other than an actor. And when your friends are all actors, look, I got, and there are friends of mine who can drop the actor thing too, and they're just, you know, but there are many who can't. And you're in a room with an actor, and I remember early on in New York being in rooms with actors who are, you know, the joke was they can't tell a story without standing up. So I always was the Midwestern guy leaning against the corner going, you know, you told this 10-minute story that you could have told in 2 minutes, and it really wasn't that interesting.
Welcome back to The Download with Justin Kaufman. Dave Hoekstra sitting in for Justin. Got our Paul Schaefer thing going on here. I love it. And our second segment with Jeff Daniels from his studio in Chelsea, Michigan, where we talk about artists staying true to their Midwest roots.
There's something about not being, and Mellencamp and Seeger, I mean, they've been in the industry. They know what makes a hit. They've got all that. The label needs a hit. They're, I don't have to deal with that. Mm-hmm. You become more of an artist, you know? Picasso and those guys, you know, they did commission. They did, you know, they would do a portrait of a king and make some money so they could paint what they wanted, but it's the one thing I do that is out of, that really is centered here. And however the Midwest or however home informs the music. I mean, I can write elsewhere, but there's something special about writing here. I don't know why it is, but it's just, you're not surrounded by people who want it to be commercial or want it, let's make a career choice. You're just writing a set list to play at the City Winery in Chicago. That's it. That's the be-all and end-all. You want that night to be the capper. There is no afterlife after that. So you focus on that, and you try to make that as great as you can, and you accept it for being, it doesn't have to go beyond that, you know? I don't have that pressure on me.
How often do you go out and play music? I know you're busy.
I'm busier now. With newsroom and post-newsroom, I'm in my fifth decade, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. Yeah, fifth decade. I'm busier in this decade than I've ever been in any other decade of my career. I'm more in demand. I'm doing more. I'm being challenged more as an actor on a consistent basis. The things I've done over since newsroom plus since then, didn't see that coming.
Yeah, why do you think that happened?
Well, I got lucky with, you know, when you move to the Midwest when you're 30, 31, and you have six movies, and you tell your agents, don't worry, I'll keep the movie career going, that I kept it going is I defied the odds. You drop back and be a supporting actor. You are no longer trying to be the biggest star in the history of stars. Because if you are, you can't live in Michigan. So I knew I was giving that up, which was okay. Comedy, when you do Dumb and Dumber, that's a career choice. And that opens up roles from Gettysburg in terms of endearment to Dumb and Dumber. There are a lot of jobs in between those two things. And that was a smart move. But I always thought I'd be Gene Hackman, Alan Arkin, Jack Lemmon, the guys in the second half of their lives, as they were older, they're still working all the time. I just thought that would be. And then the business changed. When I hit late 40s, 50, I wasn't getting, that career wasn't happening. And whether they weren't making the indie movies that Hackman and all those guys got to make, Dustin got to, all these, oh my God, Midnight Cowboy, all those things, those were, who's going to make Midnight Cowboy now? You know, so suddenly it wasn't happening, and I thought it would, and I didn't plan for that. And I'm in my 50s, and I'm playing. That's why I hooked up with Jim Fleming, my music agent, and I started hitting the road with a guitar because I thought it was over. And I was happy to have it over. I had a great run. I did a lot of things. Now let's just sell a couple things and let's just be, you know, a musician who plays clubs, and that, and I can handle that. I'm creatively, I'm happy doing that. And for 10 years, I was getting ready to do that. And then Newsroom happened, which does not happen to actors in their mid-50s, pushing 60. Doesn't happen. We're no longer interested in that older actor, and yet it did. And then it was the success it was, and the music career got put on hold because the acting career won't die. And so I go out, I have to schedule these 5-week runs, and I try to do one a year, but we literally have to, we book these gigs 6 months out. And the movie business and the TV business is the phone rings and you have a 6-month job starting in 3 weeks. So that tour you've scheduled for, you know, kill it. And so I only had to kill one career, or one tour in the last 10 years or so. I had to kill that one. I made them all up. But I really try to make it a sacred, and the agents are great. I'm just coming off a television series, April to October 1st. Don't call me in October and November. What if it's Spielberg and it's the lead? I said, if it's Spielberg and the lead, first, I'll believe that when I see it. Second, maybe not. Because it's a tour with my son, and Luke, my son, is the tour manager, and Ben's on stage with me, and I've done 40 years of movies. I haven't done that many tours, so tour wins.
I know you've had this question before, but I got to ask it. I mean, have you talked to people like Steve Martin and I don't know? I saw Harry Dean Stanton at the Mint in L.A. I mean, great, it was awesome.
I bet he was a hell of a storyteller.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but have you talked? I'm sure. Have you talked to people about being in both worlds?
I've not talked to Steve, who I think is the trick to doing it, and I think Steve has got this nailed. Is that you got to just love doing it. And if people show up and enough people show up and the promoter makes enough money, you'll get to do it again. Mm-hmm. Don't expect them to give you another career on the level of whatever you've attained as an actor. Do not expect that. I did a movie with Russell Crowe. And Russell's, he was a musician before he was an actor in Australia. And I said, Russell, you know, you and I can't go into a 2,000-seater. I mean, if we do, we're going to sell 500 seats in Sacramento or something. We're just not Aerosmith. They're not going to let us do that. You're the Gladiator and I'm in Dumb and Dumber. They're not going to let us do two things. So why don't you book gigs where it's fun? He's going, maybe I should just go out to the end of the pier in Sydney on Monday nights and just be happy with that. I could see my kids more. I wouldn't be on the tour trying to make a music career. I said, yeah. There's a reason I play opera houses and the city winery. You get 300 seats. You'll probably get 300 people that are at least interested, or some of them are just curious. Some of them are waiting for the train wreck. Some of them want to see the actor on stage have a complete meltdown because he can't be a musician. I said, bring that guy on and put him in the front row. I want that guy right there. I love that. I take the challenge on that. Yeah, that guy. Go ahead. Great. Did you see that? Oh, I'll screw. If I'm getting the vibe, yeah. I go Don Rickles on him.
Yeah. Tell us, how big is your band that you're bringing to? Give me a setup of who else coming to Chicago.
I'm going out with Ben Daniels band, but an acoustic version of it. We went out. We've swung the East Coast a couple times, Nashville with it, and also a big, huge West Coast swing, an epic tour for us in the fall of 2015. But that was amplifiers, drum set. They had some electric guitars, and we turned it up. But this is acoustic, and I really like the musicianship that we've got, the vocal harmonies with Ben and my daughter-in-law, Amanda. Wesley Fritzmeyer is going to, he was on drums on the West Coast tour. Now he's mandolin, fiddle. I mean, Wesley came out of the womb with a fiddle in his hand. His father, Jed, I played with, great bass player. He's the high school music teacher in this town. So Wesley's been around music forever, and he can play anything. He's one of those guys. He can play anything. Irish jig, jazz. Oh yeah, okay. You know, I mean, the guy doesn't blink. Tommy Rifle's our bass player. So it's a five piece, but it's acoustic. It's storytelling. It's some of them are funny, but it really is about the musicianship coming out of acoustic instruments. Ben's got a four-string tenor guitar that we got, a national tenor guitar out of the 30s that sounds just great on a couple of tunes that we got. It's that. If you're a connoisseur of acoustic music, that's what we're aiming at doing with this one.
Welcome back to Justin Kaufman's The Download, and it's Dave Hoekstra sitting in for Justin, and this is the continuation of our interview with Jeff Daniels from his studio in Chelsea, Michigan. He's going to be at City Winery on October 26th. Jeff's been on Broadway, so we ask him his advice for Bruce Springsteen on Broadway.
Well, he's cheating a little bit because he's doing five shows in a week. I don't think he's doing Wednesday matinees. That's an initiation. The bridge and tunnel crowd sitting there in the front row with a Macy's shopping bag. What did he say? You know, those people. He's probably not playing that crowd. Eight shows a week on Broadway is a marathon. But I love what he's doing. It for me, it's comparable to when I go play an opera house in Wisconsin or Woodstock, Illinois. He's got this intimate theater at the Walter Kerr, maybe 1,000 seats. It's going to feel like a living room to him with after the stadiums and all that. He's going to be able to do things because it's just him with the acoustic guitar and the piano and the story. And there's a freedom there where you don't have to push. And he's done that kind of thing before, but there's a nakedness to that that is... if it were a film, you're in a medium close-up, where if you're in a stadium, it's the big wide shot. So there are things that are great about that. I've read, who knows what he's going to do, I've read that he's going to do the same show every night. I don't buy that for a second. He'll get so bored of that. He'll be swapping out things, which you can. If you're the only guy, if you're the solo, you know, instead of that, I'm going to do this. Now, the problem with Broadway is, and he's probably completely set up for this, to deviate, but, you know, they've got light cues, they've got this thing, all the, you know, when they get the tech boys in there, you do a tech thing on Broadway, and it's 10 days of stop, start, let's fix this gel, let's make sure that light is a little more yellow, you know, and you stand there. It's 10 excruciating days of... getting the technical aspects of the light and the sound and if there are any stage pieces that move. It's just endless. But so is his big arena show. I'm sure that's the same thing. So I saw that he extended till February.
Right. I read that.
That means he's going to be playing over Christmas, which is what actors think about. We'll see if he's just doing the five shows or he takes 4 days off around Christmas. I'm looking at something, and the first thing I did, because it's a long contract if I'm going to do it on Broadway, and the first thing you look is Christmas, and you look at the current shows that are on now, because usually it's eight shows a week during Christmas week, and it's not, but it feels like they stack them, so now you're doing 14 shows Christmas week because all the tourists are in New York, so... I'll be interested to see his schedule around Christmas.
You're a fan. I saw a poster or something.
Oh, it's coming in. Yeah, I was a fan of Springsteen in the late 70s when, you know, you were getting bootleg vinyls on 14th Street in New York City because there's bootlegs of Springsteen, you know, live at wherever, live at the Bottom Line. Yeah. You know, I've got it somewhere. He was writing in a way no one else was. And then you see his show, and then you go, okay. Yeah. Well, that was a 3-hour, you just can't believe it. The first song that he opens with, whatever it might be, is Most People's Finale. He completely turned what a concert was upside down.
We have a lot in common. You're such a baseball fan. Are you going to do the Tiger Blues song?
No, I'm just short of suicidal.
I knew you were an awesome guy, but he's no longer.
Well, I think he's a smart guy. Look, there's only so much that, certainly early this year with the Tigers, kept rolling out another guy in the bullpen, 3 runs given up. Well, let's take the other, another guy. Let's go to the left-hander in the bullpen, 4 runs given. I mean, all you can do is put these guys in.
Yeah.
It's rough right now. It's rough. We've got the number one pick in the draft. That's how rough it is.
You still have season tickets?
I do. Yeah. Not giving them up.
You've had them for like over 30 years.
I have. I got 4 seats. 11 rows up from the Tiger dugout, yeah. My kids go a lot. My kids love them, and they take their friends, and I had Red Wing tickets, but I let those go. The Tiger tickets, no, they'll be in the will.
I read something. I'm just doing my research. The K-Line came to your theater? I don't know how long ago that was.
Al K-Line, the Tiger right fielder in the 60s, was my boyhood baseball hero, and then I got famous in movies, and I'm back in Detroit, and I got to meet him. Couldn't have been nicer. And my theater company, I wrote a play called The Vast Difference, because when I got my vasectomy, it was such a near religious experience for me, for any male. But I remember just turning to my wife going, I know what my next play is about. And then they were snipping the other side. And the play became this guy who didn't want to get a vasectomy. He had 5 daughters, and his wife was begging him to get the vasectomy, and he went to consult with the urologist and treated her more like a shrink than a urologist as to trying to get him to cross the line to get a vasectomy. And it just became this excruciating thing. And it brought up about a father-son stuff and all of that, and he flashed back to when his father took him to Tiger Stadium and knew a guy and gave the guy $20, so he let the father and the little boy who's the lead in the play, ends up growing up, got to be on the field. And Mickey Rourke walks by, who was a catcher for the Tigers, and I had an actor playing Mickey Rourke, and then the kid is on the field, and he's 5 years old, and he has to go to the bathroom. Has to go to the bathroom. Screaming, tantrum. And the father's like, I got you on the damn field. Is there a bathroom, Mickey? Is there any? And there is, because I've been in it. There's the dugout in Tiger Stadium. There's the dugout, and then there's a hallway that leads under the stands up to the clubhouse. In that hallway is a urinal, an open, no doors, just stuck against the wall, trough, not upright, horizontal, like a little bathtub urinal, where the players would run down 15 feet in the middle of an inning when they're up to bat, and then come back out. That way they wouldn't have to go all the way to the clubhouse. And so a friend of mine was coaching some high school game on a day off, and they got to be on the field, and he said, why don't you come down? I got to sit in the dugout. I'm going, wow, this is great. I walk down the hallway, there's his urinal. So in the play, the little kid gets taken down, and the old man's there, and they're standing there. Can't believe you have to go. Dad, I can't go. Just concentrate. You know, now they're both at the trough. And then number 6 walks by. How you doing, fellas? That's it. That's K-Line. That's their moment with K-Line. And the kid goes, Dad! And the dad says, don't ever say I never did nothing for you. That's the end of the first act. So we did the play. And somebody heard about it, and somebody got to Ernie Harwell, and Ernie Harwell and Jim Price and Al Kaline and their wives came out to the theater. We sat in the local restaurant before the show. Al was okay, but who knew what this was going to be? This could be not great for Al. Who knows? It's theater. He didn't really know. And there's that scene in the play, but there's also a scene where the father explains how great Kaline was. And he's the only player who could make the ball come to him. You know, that's kind of stuff. And the kids, and he goes, and then he would get it in the right field corner, Kaline's corner. He would turn on a dime, throw on a rope. No loop, no air, which, you know, the legend grows. Dead straight like a bullet out of a gun, right to Don Wirt's glove at third base, right in front of the bag, never had to move it an inch, out. And they act it out. They act it out on stage. The whole thing is like a little ballet between the two of them. And I looked through the curtain and looked up at Kaline, wiped a tear.